Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at the Jacksons' Victory Tour, the biggest letdown of 1984. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say 80s roll? That's right. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and I'm back with Ed Legg to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And this week we're talking about Chapter 10, Arrowhead Stadium, Kansas City, Missouri, July 6, 1984, the launch of the most anticipated tour of the blockbuster year 1984, the Jacksons' Victory Tour. Ed, is this going to live up to expectations?
Depends on who has them.
Let's say you were a 75-year-old white man with an 8-year-old granddaughter and you wanted to buy tickets for the show. How are you going to feel? Is it, you going to fit in?
Yeah, you're going to fit in. Actually, you're going to be the two demographics that fit in the most, according to our critics.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, this is kind of a hard chapter for this book, because most of the book is a celebration of triumphant achievements and musical accomplishment. And this is easily the biggest letdown and disappointment, if not of, I'd say more than just 1984. I'd say this might be one of the biggest musical disappointments of the decade. It pretty well destroyed the Jacksons as a brand.
I could, you know what? And I had no idea. Did you know this? Did you realize what this did artistically to Michael Jackson?
Well, I don't know that it did that much to Michael, but it killed the Jacksons brand dead. And it was definitely, you know, this and the Pepsi, the fire, you know, the fire on the video set, this might be the turning point in Michael's whole career, actually. I mean, he's definitely, I mean, you're never going to match Thriller. Like, that's just a given. Like, there was no way to top that. The biggest album of all time, 6 top 10 singles. I mean, virtually every track on that record is a hit single. I mean, everybody bought it. So it's like, even the most obscure track, PYT, is as well known as most hit singles from that era. But yeah, but this might be the point at which Michael's momentum stalls and never really clicks again. But the Jacksons, I mean, this was a brand, a powerful brand all through the 70s, first as the Jackson 5, and then the second half of the 70s, they were still a strong brand. They weren't, you know, Michael passes them by 79 with Off the Wall. They were dead after this. Like, Michael would never have anything to do with them, and they did try some stuff without Michael, but yeah, I don't know. I see it more as fatal to the Jacksons and a wound to Michael. But either way, I remember being disappointed by the Victory, the whole Victory thing. I didn't get it. I didn't understand why Michael was making an album with his brothers, and I especially didn't understand why he was making an album that seemed pretty obviously half-assed.
It certainly was compared to even a minor hit album in 1984, it was half-assed.
Yeah, and I mean, it was just very poor strategy on the Jacksons' part. But let's get into the way Michelangelo tells it, because he starts out with an interview with Michael Jackson, and in which they ask him, "What's your favorite thing about your job?" And he says, "Learning." And what's your dislikes? Arguing. You know, that's any musician right there. You know, that the fun part is learning the music, learning new, you know, technical tricks, performance tips. You're always going to have collaborators, you know, at least in the 80s. These days, it's a lot easier to do everything by yourself. But back then, if you weren't Prince or Stevie Wonder, you were going to have collaborators. And even Prince and Stevie Wonder had collaborators. So it's very hard to avoid, you know, argument when you're making music. But he mentions in this interview that he has a nickname that he doesn't like, and initially writes N-word nose, and he didn't say N-word, but then marked out the N-word part and left and put Big Nose, which was a nickname he was bestowed by his father, Joe. And I think that's a pretty subtle way of Matos telling us that Michael's messed up, and here's why. Is that a reasonable interpretation of that?
I think it is. And you look at what's the biggest difference in him on the cover of Thriller, between Thriller and Off the Wall?
That's the nose stuff.
Yeah. And what a great artist he still was at that point. And both of, you know, all the way up to Thriller, what a confident guy he was. And you said it about momentum before. I'll leave it at that at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the funny thing is, I like that first nose job that he got. I think if he would have stopped there, that, you know, it would have been perfect. He looked better to me in 79 with his own nose.
I agree.
And he also started lightening his skin color around this time, although the Battaglio, I think that's how you pronounce it, diagnosis came through around that same time. So there's still some controversy there. But, I mean, I don't think we have to defend Michael on the skin bleaching charge anymore either. I mean, there was a lot of dust in the air. Oh, no, he's not lightening his skin. He's just, you know, got this condition and he's treating it. But come on, he was lightening his skin. I mean, that seems pretty apparent. But this, I think it's pretty shrewd of Matos to zero in on the nose, because the plastic surgery became the most visible manifestation of whatever it was inside Michael that was deeply wrong. And it ultimately reached the point where there was a website for a long time, The History of Michael Jackson's Face, which just, you know, was a really cruel, hateful website that just, you know, took pictures of him through different periods and then made jokes about, you know, now he's looking like the Joker, and then the next year he's looking like the Penguin, and, you know, and here comes Two-Face, and you know, but it became undeniable that something was wrong with Michael, that he had mutilated himself with basically addicted to plastic surgery, and then of course the more serious allegations. But the second thing that Matos gets in there is a little bit of just some of the facts. And this is the kind of stuff he heard constantly in 1984, but he rolls out this one. I can't remember who it was quoting here, but some journalist put in an article in 1984 that if you took David Bowie's Let's Dance, all the sales of Let's Dance, plus all the sales of Synchronicity by the Police, all the sales of the Rolling Stones Undercover, and that album's only there because the Rolling Stones were famous. That was kind of a stiff album. It didn't even make number one.
Yeah.
Culture Club, Color by Numbers, Quiet Riot, Mental Health, massive album. Duran Duran, Seven and the Ragged Tiger, another massive album. Culture Club was massive too. Take all of those, add them together, and double them, and then you get the sales of Thriller. I mean, that's how big he was, because, you know, Bowie was enormous with Let's Dance. Police and Bowie were both hitting career peaks. So was Duran Duran, actually, with that album. Actually, all of those artists, except for the Stones, were hitting career peaks there. Yeah, I mean, just pretty awe-inspiring that, like, you know, and then they zero in on the Guinness Book debut and how this is one of the biggest days of the Michael Jackson calendar year. It was it's pretty much like the jerk when the, you know, the new phone book's here, except he was in the Guinness Book of World Records, you know, over and over again. But it's pretty much the same mentality. Just a kid who's, you know, I mean, who's into the Guinness Book of World Records? 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that was Michael, you know, and that was kind of the beauty of him as an artist. But as we learned later, that was also, you know, had feet of clay for sure. But let's go ahead and hear our first song. And this is Michael Jackson from the Victory album by the Jacksons featuring Mick Jagger, State of Shock. State of Shock by Michael Jackson, the Jacksons featuring Mick Jagger, who was trying to launch his solo career around this time. And I was about to just heap opprobrium all over this song when Steph tells me she liked it before the show starts. I might even have to drag her in to defend this, but to me, this was a very weak single. It was obviously an attempt to rewrite Beat It.
Yeah. Wrong.
Wrong. Here's Steph. So speak up, Steph. What was your take? It wasn't an attempt to rewrite Beat It, and Mick Jagger was cool in 1984. Is this?
Well, I was very young when this came out, but I was old enough to appreciate music. And I had a group of friends, you know, like-minded. We were very pop-centric. We weren't into metal or any of that stuff. But when this song came out, it was snappy and it had a good beat. And we loved Michael Jackson. And so by virtue of that, the song was great. But as I've gotten older, I have listened to it multiple times. I love it. The beat is so catchy. I mean, they could release this today and I doubt it would, you know, break into the top 10 or even the top 40, but it would be catchy enough for people to enjoy. I mean, I think it's still great. I can't help myself. I love it.
Well, I mean, it's a free country and you know, little kids are going to like things, but I don't know. The uncoolness factor of Mick Jagger here was really getting all over Michael and the Jacksons, I think. And Mick is on this roll. Like, he's actually, the Dance in the Streets video with David Bowie hasn't even come out yet, which is going to be, I think, one of the worst videos of all time. And a video so noxious and so overplayed that it literally killed David Bowie's reign as a superstar and killed any chance Mick Jagger had of a successful solo career. But I think this video and collaboration, Steph and her friends aside, I think the historical record shows this was not a successful collab. Ed, can you be the tiebreaker here?
You know what's weird? I only think I've heard this song one time, and I remember the riff. And my friend who was more mainstream than I despised it, which of course made me on Stephanie's side in that respect. But you know what? Mick Jagger had fair warning, and just continued, and no matter what happened, just kept going through with it.
And elaborate on the fair warning point.
Yep.
But what do you mean by he had fair warning?
This song was a fair warning. You saw what it did. Did it even do anything? I mean, I heard it one time. And, you know, this was a good example of where he was going to go. He tried to have a pot. The thing, it really, to me, the arbiter is Charlie Watts, who said, "I do not understand why Mick Jagger's trying to have a pop music career."
I mean, that was a good question. He was desperate for a hit. Like, let's see, I'm looking at that. It made it to number 14.
Oh, wow.
Which is still a massive flop, given how hot Michael Jackson was at that point, that this is the lead single from the album that's going to be, you know, the biggest tour of the year. It had everything behind it. It only made it to number three, which to me is a relative flop, given how hot Michael was, how anticipated the tour was. This is the first single off the Victory album. And you had Mick Jagger, which you would think would be a plus, but I think he's maybe already shown that he's a drag, a commercial drag at this point in his career. And the thing is that 1981 Stones tour movie, you know what I'm talking about? Let's spend the night together.
Yeah.
That was on pay cable constantly. Like that was on the movie channel all the time. And I watched it a lot. And I did not like it at all. And I love the Stones. Like, I've always loved the Stones. But I thought Mick was already looking old and awkward. He'd already kind of shriveled up a little bit. And he was wearing pastel colors. And that was the tour with the giant inflatable penis, which I just found ridiculously embarrassing. And it just had try hard written all over it. And it had none of the aura of menace that the Stones had at the beginning of the 70s. It's just old dudes trying to be hip. And, you know, I don't know. Steph and her little friends were enjoying State of Shock, and lots of people did. It went to number three. But that just tells you how popular Michael Jackson was. I think that the fact that this wasn't a massive number one for where Michael was in his career at that point is definitely, you know, a step back. And the thing is, the tragedy of this whole thing is Michael knew this. He knew he had just put everything he had into his masterpiece. He wanted to take the whole year off. Like, he was looking for a ticket to Hollywood. He wanted to get into Hollywood, which is the logical career move of somebody in his position. I mean, he's the biggest star in the world. He's looking at people like the Beatles and Elvis as his role model. There's literally no African-American role models for this level of success, unless you're talking about Bob Marley on a global scale. But even that's just happening, as we talked about in a couple episodes ago. But Marley's fame is still growing globally through this whole period, getting a massive boost from the Legends compilation. And, you know, and Marley had died so young and had never really been an American superstar. So I don't see Michael looking at him as a model. His models are going to be Elvis, the Beatles, Frank Sinatra. And you know, there's not really anybody else that's reached that kind of level of fame. So, you know, it's perfectly logical to take a breather. You spent 2 years making Thriller, 3-4 years making Thriller. The idea that they're going to rush out an album and then rush out a tour is just really bad planning. And it did not come from Michael. It came from his dad and it came from his brothers, all of whom were broke. They're all living like they're Michael Jackson, but that only Michael is earning like he's Michael Jackson. And I guess Michael wasn't that interested in just giving him handouts. But I mean, this is a point in time when the VHS tape, the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller, nearly sold 1 million copies. I think it sold like 900,000, 900,000. You know, the guy's just King Midas here, and his brothers are totally dragging him down. And speaking of which, here's Torture by the Jacksons. This features Michael and Jermaine, although I sampled the part that features Michael. Torture by the Jacksons featuring Michael and Jermaine. And I don't know, I didn't care for that one either. I got that album as a present. I'm trying to remember, I think it was my Aunt Vede. It might have been my Aunt Wanda that gave me that. But I mean, this was just, you know, and I remember trying to like it and just failing. Did you ever have the whole album or did you just do the singles?
You talking about Victory or
Victory? I'm talking about Victory. Yeah.
No, I did not. I did not. And Jermaine's single wasn't on that album, was it? Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming. That wasn't on there, right?
No, that's on his solo album that came out at the same time. Torture was on Victory.
It did not interest me. And what's weird is I actually weren't the Jacksons good in 1981 on that tour? Wasn't that a successful tour, or is that just the one critic I knew who went and saw it and told me it was good?
I believe they were good. I mean, I didn't see them. All accounts were that you know it was solid, successful stuff, and it reminds me of Rod Stewart and the Faces, actually. Like Michael had used the Jacksons as a touring vehicle, even though he had a solo career. But it wasn't quite at the point where it was obvious he needed to go solo yet. Like there was still, I mean, even though Off the Wall did like 7 million, versus, 1 million for Triumph, in 81 or 80, there were still hit singles off Triumph and it was relatively strong, you know. But again, I was 12 and I wasn't like glued to the billboards. I don't know for sure how well it was done, but I think it's I think the fundamental dynamic, and it's not totally fair to Jermaine, I think, but the dynamic became Jermaine versus Michael, because Jermaine had left the group in the 70s. He'd stayed with Motown since his wife Hazel was Berry Gordy's daughter, and so he chose his wife over his brothers. Terrible position to be put in when they left Motown and signed with Epic CBS when Walter Yetnikoff lured them away. But Jermaine came back for this one, and this was the first time all six brothers are going to be on stage together. At least that was the plan. They announced the tour in November 1983, and initially Don King, the boxing promoter, was the promoter, and he brought $500,000 checks for each brother. I don't know if he gave Michael one, but he gave all the others and handed it out when they made the tour announcement. And this was all Joe Jackson's doing. He did this without checking with Michael first. Michael had fired him as a manager previously and had his own management, and his career just went in a different direction from his brothers, largely because he's more talented, but also because he wasn't being managed by Joe, and he didn't have this big weird family organization that he had to move through to make decisions. He was able to make his own decisions, but and this tour, they Don King cuts a $8 million deal with Pepsi, no, a $5 million deal with Pepsi, and then later they find out that Lionel Richie had an $8 million of Pepsi, and Quaker Oats wanted to give him $10 million, but King gave Pepsi an exclusive when there was no reason. You couldn't have been sponsored by Pepsi and Quaker Oats, you know, like just gross mismanagement there. And you know, Matos goes into a little bit the controversies around corporate sponsorship of tours. Like, this is something that the Frank Sinatra generation would have had no problem with. Even Elvis generation would have had no problem with. But after the Beatles never allowed any kind of sponsorship. They didn't let their music be used in commercials. It was a big controversy in the 80s when John Lennon's Revolution was used in a commercial, and Michael Jackson got blamed for that too, because he had bought the publishing rights to the Lennon and McCartney songs that the Beatles performed. But in 1981, the Stones had actually broken the barrier, and Jovan Perfume sponsored the Tattoo U tour. And then, you know, by the mid 80s, it was something that was done, although it was still kind of controversial. The controversy really kicked in for the Jacksons, though, when they were selling their tickets at $28 each, which, for comparison, the Stones tour, I think 2 years earlier, had been $14, and or 3 years earlier, had been $14. So they're doubling the prices, and then you could only buy it by mail and only in blocks of four. So if you're some little kid saving your lunch money, you're not going to be able to buy tickets. And the real kicker was you could send in your money they would take it. And if you didn't win the lottery and didn't get tickets, I think they kept your money, which is just egregious BS. And, you know, it was things like this that led Don King to get fired before the tour even started. A guy named Frank Russell's brought in. Then he's fired. And then Chuck Sullivan, of all people, who's the owner of the New England Patriots, takes over. And then, ironically, Foxborough, Massachusetts wouldn't even allow the tour to be played in his stadium. So, you know, this thing was just snake bit all the way through. And I mean, Don King, as your promoter, this is a guy who had a bad reputation in boxing. Why on earth would you bring him in to manage the biggest tour in history? Just, you know, just sort of amazingly wrongheaded. And then they get into this whole thing about how there are 6 Jackson records in the R&B top 50 in Cashbox when the tour starts. And there's Torture, which we talked about. There's State of Shock, which we've already talked about. And then Rebbie Jackson, the oldest sister's song Centipede, which featured Michael. Jermaine's Dynamite. Don't Stand Another Chance by Janet Jackson. And then LaToya's Hot Potato. But, and there would have been 7, except that Jermaine's track from his solo album, Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, which featured Michael wouldn't let them release that as a single. So Arista, Jermaine's label, printed up an airplay-only promotional 3-song EP. That almost makes me feel sorry for Jermaine. Does it pull your heartstrings at all?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that, I mean, I like that. Actually, I remember that song, and I actually kind of liked it. It kind of reminds me of that Rockwell song, though. You know, and that year was.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes. Go ahead.
We're about to bring that up, that Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell, who's the son of Barry Gordy, Kennedy Gordy, I believe is his name, with backing vocals by Michael. That went to number one. And there was a lot of intrigue around that. I remember on MTV, they were really cute about whether or not Michael was on the track. Like, somebody big is on this track that you might not expect, but they would never just come out and say it. And I remember being baffled at the time when that came on. Like, we didn't even have MTV and Borger, but we had Friday Night Videos, and they were trying to, you know, make hay with that. And I was just baffled. I had no idea it was Michael Jackson. Just being a cracker. This is a total corn dog. But anyway, let's take a sponsor break and let the audience soak in the magnitude of my corn dogness.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these 3 EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And so one last knock on State of Shock, and I think Stephanie will have to admit this is a real salient point, was that Weird Al did a parody video of State of Shock that's nothing more than epic executive Harvey Leeds singing the riff tunelessly, which.
That sounds hysterical.
I know, it sounds like the funniest video Weird Al ever did. I mean. Just brutal. And it turns out that the connection that Mick and Michael shared was a lawyer. So they had the same attorney. And this is Mick's attempt to go solo was the talk of the music industry for about 2.5 years. And then the ensuing feud between Mick and Keith Richards of the Stones just went back and forth, you know, bad-mouthing each other over it. There was a massive major label bidding war. Walter Yetnikoff won that one, but again, it was a door prize. I mean, a booby prize for sure, because Mick's solo album She's the Boss flopped hard. I think that was the following year, and it just the whole Mick thing. I mean, I have friends that are my age that hate the Rolling Stones, like never even gave the Rolling Stones a chance because Mick's work was so embarrassing in this whole period. There's another solo video he did in 85 or 86 where he's like jogging in front of a green screen and he looks like the Vulture Muppet. Remember the Vulture Muppet? I can't remember what his
name is.
But I mean, it just out there embarrassing himself with bad work, high profile bad work. And there's nothing, no better way to kill your career than really push crap out there. And you know, the duet thing is what we also got to mention. Paul McCartney, who Michael Jackson had actually done successful duets with, including Say 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 and The Girl Is Mine. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. You know, much more natural fits. Like Paul, it's clear when you hear the songs that Paul and Michael did together. For one thing, it's never as corny as what Paul did with Stevie Wonder, Ebony and Ivory.
Oh, God, that's true.
Yeah, that was just a real besmirch on both of their exalted legacies there. I mean, it's not abysmal. You know, it's not the most... It's probably the most embarrassing thing Stevie Wonder's ever done that I know of. It's certainly not the most embarrassing thing Paul McCartney's ever done, because this is the guy who made... Mary Had a Little Lamb, a single in the early 70s, and wrote a song, Let's Stay Home Tonight. Like, you know, but the Michael Paul McCartney, you can tell that Paul was contributing to the songwriting, whereas in State of Shock, Mick's just shouting the same melody, the verse melody on top of Michael. It's like he didn't bring anything to the table. But they don't talk much It does mention in this chapter that Michael had learned to invest in music publishing from Paul, but it doesn't get into the whole thing where Michael buys the rights to the Beatles catalog out from under Paul, which is, you know, a classic story of music biz mentorship and betrayal. I'd say, Michael, that was his graduation as a music biz player. You know, to me, that was like, that's how the music biz works. Like,
yeah, sadly.
You know, I mean, if Paul wanted the rights to those songs, he and Yoko Ono should have gotten together and agreed on a deal. But Yoko, for some reason, thought she could get him cheaper, and Paul deferred to her. She's a really smart businesswoman. So she, if it hadn't been for the X Factor of Michael Jackson coming in, I think they were thinking, who's going to make this investment? Who's a big enough player that's interested? And they knew who was buying song publishing rights. And this was long before Hypnosis. This was back when Hypnosis was a company that made Pink Floyd album covers and not a company that pays hundreds of millions of dollars for song publishing like the modern Hypnosis. But anyway, now we get to the concert itself and the competition or an event that Matos brings in for comparison was the NAACP's convention in Kansas City in July. It was happening right at the same time, and all three of the Democratic contenders for the nomination are there. It's easy to forget, you know, we look back on the presidential election of 1984 as this massive blowout by Ronald Reagan, where he wins 49 states and Walter Mondale only holds on to his home state of Minnesota. But at this point in July, the primary was still going. Mondale was fending off challenges from Gary Hart and Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson is going to come back and run again very strongly in 1988. Gary Hart was expected to be the runaway nominee in 1988, but he, of course, took a cruise on the ship named Monkey Business. I think the woman's name was Donna Rice.
Yes, it was. Absolutely.
One of the classic political scandals of the 80s into that career. But anyway, it was still a viable race. And Reagan, the recession of 82 was still remembered well enough of 79 to 82 and the high, you know, 20% interest rates, and all the other things that Paul Volcker, the Federal Reserve, did to get inflation under control. So that Reagan was still pretty unpopular, but the economy kept improving through the course of the year, and Reagan just ran a better campaign than Walter Mondale and smoked him. But I don't know. What was the point of bringing up the NAACP convention? Was it just a contrast with the massively white audiences at the Jackson tours?
That is a very good point, because that's kind of the conclusion of the chapter. But what kind of strikes me is how, did you know this was not that great a show? I mean, I didn't. It was so much hype, and I don't think I just never saw any of the old guard rock critics' thoughts on it. And it didn't come to Atlanta till the fall, by which time it almost got by me. It was on a Friday night in the fall, which, you know, meant I was working. And it was at a stadium, and in those days I was still a little bit paranoid about stadium shows after one horrible afternoon waiting for Kiss in 1976. But it was really bad. But I mean, they didn't come on till 11:30, and it was a school night. The first day of school the next day. So that makes an impression, junior year. Anyway, but I mean, I did not know. And the thing is, because it was the Jacksons, I actually was more interested because I knew about the 81. I knew people who'd gone to the 81 show, and I'd kind of, you know, I was enough of a fan from, you know, from pre-adolescence and their music then, and then just paid attention from then on, to be interested. But I don't remember anyone ever saying, this was kind of a revelation, this chapter, because it made me feel better for not ever going. I mean, I was a little interested, but there were so many prohibitions. For somebody who worked nights and worked weekends, it would have just been too much trouble for me.
Yeah. Now, I'm pretty sure that Time Magazine, of all things, panned it. And Time Magazine was so big for me because I was spending summers in the Guadalupe Mountains with my brother, the forest ranger. So we got no newspaper, and the only TV channel we could pick up was one of those like local, it had no news on it. It wasn't a network channel. It was you know, a non-affiliated channel. So it was like, you could watch Cagney and Lacey reruns and Magnum PI reruns on it, but you never got any news. So the only news we had pretty much was AM radio and Time magazine once a week. And so I would just pore over those Time magazines, and I'm pretty sure that they had, now March of that year, they had a Michael Jackson cover. So I don't think they gave him a second cover. Yeah. Cause Andy Warhol had painted that portrait of Michael Jackson, in March, but there was definitely, at least my memory. And I looked and couldn't find the article. When I was prepping for this show, I should have looked a little harder, but my memory of it was that Time magazine was tearing the show apart. And if Time magazine in 1984 is like dissecting your rock and roll show, it wasn't a very good show. Like, you know, if even Time, because Time magazine was still massive at that point, but it was very square. It was not where you went for your music news. I was aware. I mean, it was obvious that the Victory album was a dud, and the hype of the off the tour was all negative as far as I heard. But anyway, let's hear our next one. This is the song Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming by Jermaine Jackson featuring Michael, but kind of a double-edged sword, since he wouldn't let it be released as a single and had that right since he was on the record. If he hadn't been on the record, maybe it would have been a hit. Probably not, because I think Michael has a lot. But this is Jermaine and Michael, Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming. And I think, again, I picked the Michael verse. You slipped into my room. Could be magic. Could be fantasy. Could it be that we're getting up? Oh, your voice whispers in the dark. You talk into my heart. And that was Michael Jackson's guest stint in Jermaine Jackson's Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming. And if you just go back and listen to these songs, it's almost physically painful how much better Michael is than his brothers. You know, the rest of the Jacksons were just, other than Janet, of course, but the brothers, and they had their moments, but mostly in the 70s. I'm trying to remember. I mean, it seemed like there were moments by the other brothers that I liked on their earlier albums. But by this point, it was just so obvious that Michael was the runaway talent here. I don't know. It's just kind of, I was about to say, it just seems kind of cruel of him to withhold, you know, his permission for his brother to capitalize. But then you look at how much Michael was giving to his family. He's already carried them to fame and fortune. I mean, it was his dazzling talent in the late 60s that got the attention of Motown and Diana Ross. And I know the whole myth about Diana Ross didn't really discover them, but she did mentor them, particularly Michael. And in fact, as Matos mentions, when he had his second nose job, or third, I think he went back for his third already, he asked to have a nose like Diana Ross. So, you know, there's definitely, and when I was talking about Michael looking at role models, Diana Ross is one I should have mentioned, because she was so obviously his one of his dominant role models. Her and Fred Astaire, I would say, are the two dominant role models. But anyway, I don't know. Given how much Michael is giving to his family, I guess I'll have to score it even. Like, it's fine for him to strangle Jermaine's commercial prospects like that. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's like, how can I mediocritize the most successful, you know, piece of vinyl ever, you know, that's what's so, it's so abominable. And it this gave me such a new appreciation for it, because I think that, you know, I just wasn't paying that close of attention. I wasn't reading Time like you were. But it sounds so obvious. It reminds me of what he had to survive and part of what led to everything later. I mean, it's certainly being insanely rich and famous and insanely successful and makes you crazy.
Yeah.
It's like that Frank Sinatra thing that you recently replayed where you note that it's like a trap or being a hostage and you never get out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel for the guy. And I happen to see after we started doing this, and reading this book, and I was reading it before we started to do it. I saw one of those top 10 shows on, you know, doing some channel surfing, and they showed him do the moonwalk at the Motown.
25th anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the physical confidence that guy had was so, it just leapt out of the screen. It was remarkable. And that's not hindsight. I mean, I saw it then, and I had seen moonwalking before, and I actually saw Harry Belafonte do some things in the mid 70s because he played at the theater where I worked, but that he was so physically confident. And Liza Minnelli, actually, when he died, she came right on TV and talked about, as a dancer, how great it was. And she got really irritated when people started bringing up, you know, the unfortunate turn of his life later, you know. But
yeah,
and I didn't pay attention to her. I was irritated with that about her. But then when I saw that, I don't think I know anything. I mean, I don't know anything about dancing, but that you could just see it. How what a great dancer he was.
Yeah, it was obvious that just an incredibly gifted, you know, once in a generation talent as a dancer and as a singer and songwriter.
Yes. Yeah.
But the fact, you know, he mentioned the whole double date with Brooke Shields and Emmanuel Lewis thing at the Grammys. And he doesn't mention the Emmanuel Lewis part in this chapter. But he does mention, you know, that he was taking some flack in magazine letters to the editor of magazines, might have even been Ebony, where somebody, you know, was saying, basically, you know, Michael Jackson dating white girls like Brooke Shields and Tatum O'Neal is not cool. It's sending a message to our kids that if you're a successful black man, you should be dating white women instead of a black woman. And so he's getting pushback for that. And if people even knew what was really going on at this point, you know, he would have gotten a lot more pushback. But again, I don't know if he had started doing, you know, abusing children at this point, which I believe we can say he was a child abuser. I think that's pretty well proven, and he's dead and can't sue me for libel. But, you know, it seems pretty obvious that the guy was a pedophile. And to me, the tragedy of it is he was so young and he was pushed into seeking fame and fortune. He didn't make that choice himself, and he wasn't old enough to make choices when he made that. And my understanding, at least, of pedophilia is that frequently offenders were victims as children.
Yes.
And
yep.
It just seems so obvious that somebody, you know, abused Michael, not just his father physically and verbally abusing him, but somebody abused him sexually. And if you watch the Ghost video from the late 90s, have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't.
I should have made you watch that. You got to watch that before the next time we talk about Michael in this series, because by the late 90s, I had gone all the way around full circle. Like, I had gone from being, I think, weirded out when I started seeing him with Emmanuel Lewis and stuff at events. And then by the time Bad comes out, he's like hanging out with Macaulay Culkin, and it's pretty obviously weird. And then, you know, by the early 90s, they're doing parodies of it on Saturday Night Live. Do you remember that sketch? I think it was Tim Meadows plays Michael, and he's bragging to some woman at a bar about how he could just take her to Toys R Us, even though they're closed, and buy her anything in the store. you know, and talking about how he has a pinball game in his room and all this kind of stuff. You know, it was so obvious. But so by the late 90s, when he does the Ghost video, some of my ghoulish evil friends and I, we were just into hate watching Michael because we knew he was a child molester. And we were just like, how does anybody not notice this? And then the Ghost video is like one of these, like, you know, it's like Thriller has metastasized, and it's like, you know, some 40 or 50 minute long video. And it's this whole movie where Michael plays this sort of evil white record business executive who's leading a group of kids into this castle that's owned by this mysterious, maybe evil figure who's kind of Dracula-like, who's also played by Michael. And at some point, the Michael Count Dracula character and the Michael Jewish record business guy have this confrontation. And I've always thought that's the guy, that's who molested Michael, you know. But I don't know who that character was based on, and maybe that's not what happened, but that's just the take I've had on it. Just
wow.
Yeah, you've got to watch that video. It's very interesting. I wouldn't say it's something you can appreciate at face value, but if you're interested in the Michael Jackson story, it is definitely a big piece of the puzzle. And it's just fascinating to me. I mean, somebody, the way Michael Jackson goes, like if you watch a video of Michael Jackson doing ABC in 1969, when he's what, 7, 8 years old.
And
he's so beatific. He's this beautiful child.
Yeah.
He's taken such joy in his gift. He's such an incredible dancer and singer. He's so charismatic, and you know he knows it. And by even the, I think it was the one of the videos for Bad, no, maybe it was History. Remember the video he did during the Super Bowl? Like it made its live debut during the Super Bowl, or it was a live performance during the Super Bowl, where he smashes a car and grabs his crotch like 1,000 times?
Yes, yes, yes. Yep.
You know, and so by that point, he's already become repulsive, but he's just so popular that everybody's like just going along with it.
And so true.
And it's just so sad and awful. And you just see what, you know, the music biz in reality has done to him. But let's go ahead and hear our final song. This is Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell, who's Barry Gordy's son, by the way. They didn't mention that at the time. With Michael Jackson doing the backup vocal. And that's Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell, a.k.a. Kennedy Gordy, the son of Barry Gordy. And yeah, the only hit the guy had, the massive number one hit. I think he might have had another top 20 hit off that album. But yeah, pretty much one and done, and pretty much rode Michael's coattails for that one hit that he got. But I guess the last piece in the chapter that we should discuss is this letter from a girl named LaDonna Jones that appeared in the Dallas Morning News. So she was from Dallas, or from the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, at least, and she was complaining of the high ticket prices. And it's the classic 11-year-old black girl who's been saving her newspaper route money to buy tickets, and she can't get to $28, much less 28 times four, because you had to buy it in blocks of four. And Michael is actually aware of that, and actually spoke. I think they had her come out to the show and tried to make it right. But, you know, that's an example of the kind of bad PR they're getting. And the other thing was that they were losing money on this tour because the stage was too big. And so the stadiums had to be reconfigured to fit it, and they lost seating, which, you know, anytime you take a row of seats out of a stadium presentation, that's money out of the balance books. And they ended up in the red. Just a complete disaster on every level. If you're doing a cash-in tour, you really need to watch the bottom line and make sure you're cashing in. But then Michael was the one who was behind the stage set, probably, and he might not have been interested in the tour turning to profit. So, yeah, it gets complicated. And then the last piece is, and we mentioned this already, but he quotes Grail Marcus, pointing out that this is both the oldest and the youngest audience ever seen at a white or at a rock concert. I say white because Matos points out that Marcus doesn't mention that it's also the whitest audience at an R&B show ever. And as a kicker, all six guys didn't even perform on most of the tours because Jackie Jackson was injured and missed half the tour after being allegedly run over by his wife, who had discovered his relationship with a young Paula Abdul. So,
who was the choreographer, right? Didn't she do some work for him?
Yeah.
That's astounding.
Yeah, she was a choreographer. I doubt she's doing a lot for Jackie in the choreography department.
But... I think you're right.
He definitely wasn't dancing after his wife ran him over, allegedly. So, yeah. Just the human condition in its full splendor here this week. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Final thoughts on the Jackson's Victory Tour?
Yeah, it made me sad. And actually, you know, it kind of took me beyond the step you just described. This guy clearly was abused. And I happen to hear in the fall of 84, I was driving around in the middle of rural Georgia on a Friday night after a high school football game. And there was a syndicated show on about the Jacksons. And Michael was one of the people interviewed. I don't know anything else about it. I don't know the provenance. But the thing that I remember vividly is him talking about Father Joe beating them. And, you know, yes, it was the 80s. And yes, you know, in those days, corporal punishment was still socially accepted. But
it was retreating. Like.
Yes, it was.
You were sort of an outlier if you were still getting like hit with a paddle at school, which I was.
Yes.
But we felt like, you know, well, we're rednecks in a small town. And this is what happens to us.
Right.
But felt like when I lived in Arlington, Texas, which is close to Dallas, you know, for me, that was the big city. And there was no paddling in the schools in Arlington, you know, but there was definitely paddling in schools. But anyway, back to your story.
Well, he said that he was talking about one of his brothers did something, and I can't remember if it was musical related or not, but then he said, Daddy beat him. And he said it in the most matter of fact way. And I mean, I noticed it then. And yes, I came up and I didn't get paddled, but you know, I came up in the Southern realm where, you know, Dad would come in and say, I'm going to kill you. You know, that kind of, even though that wasn't what he was going to do, but that whole, you know, don't make Dad mad. And my grandfather was way even, you know, was that brutal, but, you know, the Depression era approach, but it jumped out. And I mean, it's obvious. We don't even have to do any detective work to know this guy grew up in just this tour is emblematic.
Yeah. And we haven't even, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say,
go ahead.
Sorry. We haven't even mentioned the Jehovah's Witness thing, which is another whole weird thing. And it was interesting that Michael, his mother, and two of his sisters, Latoya and Rebbe, are the Jehovah's Witnesses in the family. So it's not even the whole family. And I don't know at what point Michael became a Jehovah's Witness, but he was addicted to it because church was the only place where he got treated like a regular person. That was the only place people would just treat him like a human being and not as somebody special or somebody they wanted money from, or they wanted, you know, a musical opportunity from. And when your own brothers are looking at you as a payday, that's gotta be so alienating. You know, you can't even just chill with your brothers. You have no peers, you know.
Yep.
I mean, the only people you can talk to that can remotely relate to your life experiences are people like Liza Minnelli and Liz Taylor, who are also either child stars or raised by celebrities, you know, Macaulay Culkin.
And abused.
Yeah.
And abused.
And abused. Yeah, they were all abused. I don't know about Macaulay Culkin. Well, I do think we know about Macaulay Culkin. I don't know about Emmanuel Lewis.
Right. True.
But it seems like child star in general is a very risky thing to push your kid into. But
yep.
you know, and also that he was being dogged by gay rumors that he was gay already at this point. And the defense was, you know, oh, his church is too conservative for that. And they talk about how they were too conservative for the Thriller video, how he almost retracted the whole thing and then was satisfied. You know, he put a disclaimer on it and satisfied the church and himself with that disclaimer. But yeah, I mean, I don't know a ton about the Jehovah's Witness ideology, but I do know that, and now Harold Bloom wrote a book, not Alan Bloom, the Closing the American Mind guy, but Harold Bloom, the literary scholar, wrote a book on American religions where he discusses, you know, Christian Science and American Baptists and the AME Church of African Americans and the Church of Latter-day Saints and the Jehovah's Witnesses are one of them. And Bloom's just absolutely scathing about the Jehovah's Witness. Ideology is the wrong term. Theology, I guess, is the right term. You know, just scathing about how negative the Jehovah's Witness theology is. And it limits heaven to, you know, like 144,000 people ever are the only ones who are going to make it to heaven. So it's this very... but it has an incredible hold on some people. I think that the guitar player for Fishbone actually quit the band because he reconnected with his father, who had been a crappy father, and they bonded over both converting to Jehovah's Witness at the same time, or maybe the son converted. Anyway, but you know, Prince was a Jehovah's Witness, I think a late convert as well. But anyway, just another ingredient in the stew that's baking Michael Jackson's brain to a horrible shriveled pulp and you know, lead it to ruin. It's just a monumental tragedy, you know, and I think, you know, Michael's victims obviously the biggest sufferer, but I spare some compassion for Michael too. I mean, that's the worst kind of perpetrator you can be without killing somebody, and you know, for one person to embody both the most beloved things a human being can do, which is make other people happy through their gifts, and then at the same time be somebody who abuses children in the worst way possible. That's a lot to process. And this chapter only really talks about the flop of the tour.
Yeah. So, yeah.
We're on that whole subtext, but
the ingredients are all there, you know, that's the thing. It's heading in that direction.
Yeah, it is. And then just a, you know, I guess Bad comes out in 87 and it already has kind of flop sweat all over it where everybody's hoping for Thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, because I remember being excited about it coming out, and I wasn't the biggest Michael Jackson fan, but it was such a big deal that, you know, I was down. I went out and bought the tape the day it dropped and tried to like it, you know, tried real hard to like it, and just it was okay, but it wasn't Thriller. It wasn't even Off the Wall. I mean, Off the Wall is a great album. It wasn't anywhere close to Off the Wall. So something had already gone wrong with Michael by that point, and you know, here we are. But so I've already asked for a final thought, so now I don't know how to get out of this. And
I'll say this. It's just astounding that this is the biggest popular music album ever, and what he gets in return is his family bigfooting him and pulling him right down back down to their level. I mean, it is, you know, you said it already. He didn't have brothers to go through this with, you know.
No, I mean, you'd think he would be in a Beatles type situation where you have four guys united, you know, back to back to back facing the world. And instead he's with his own brothers, but it's more like Elvis and the Memphis Mafia, except they're not even sycophants. It's like as if Elvis was picked on by the Memphis Mafia. It's just, you know, I mean, yeah, this is how Michael Jackson becomes Michael Jackson, both the good and the bad. So for Ed Legg, I'm Nate Wilcox. We've been discussing Michelangelo Matos's thought-inspiring Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And next week, finally, the purple one is going to appear.
Yeah.
So
here we go.
That's right. A much more upbeat chapter and a much less morally ambiguous figure. So here we go. We got that to look forward
to. Let's do it. Yep.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate continues the Holy Roll series with an interview with Mahalia Jackson biographer Mark Burford. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.